Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Law Debating Society in collaboration with Ines Sell and Elsa Molta, entitled Common Good versus Individual Rights in the Light of the Divorce Issue. This debate is chaired by Dr. David Frigeri.
We're framing divorce in the light of the common good and, or versus, we'll see how the debate proceeds, versus individual rights. So if there's one rule that I'd like to sort of impose on this debate, it's that the speakers, whether they're from the floor, students will be making interventions today, or from the panel, do frame this issue, that is divorce, in the light of this philosophical or even legal issue. So common good versus individual rights. Besides that rule, I'd just invite speakers to stick to the time that's been allotted on the program. And now I'll just go on to mention briefly the proceedings. Dr. Ruth Farrugia, an expert in family law, will be giving the keynote speech. And the keynote speech today is Divorce Legislation from Las Vegas to Ireland. Basically, Dr. Farrugia will take us through the legal and possibly even the societal reasons for a big variance in divorce legislation throughout the world. Later, we will have the first session, which is Common Good versus Individual Rights. Reverend Professor Peter Serafino Glott will talk about the relevance of the notion of common good in the divorce debate, and whereas Professor Kenneth Wayne will replique with a debate on why individual and minority rights have to be reckoned with in the divorce debate. Later we will open the floor to two students to make their contributions on the matter. Later we will have a second session, Divorce for and Against, or for or against, an intervention by Professor Arnold Cassola, Dr. Austin Bencini, who is representing the Switch Bla Divorzio movement, and Dr. Deborah Schembri will close with the question why Malta needs divorce. Dr. Deborah Schembri represents the EVA movement. So without further ado, I leave the floor to Dr. Farrugia to give us her presentation. Thanks very much.
And this is essentially a union of hearts and minds. The state should recognize and regulate this marriage because it has an interest in stable romantic partnerships and in the concrete needs of spouses and any children they may choose to rear. So you'll notice there's a state interest, although a different one, in both. Now, some of you may have been following the case of Radmacher versus Granatino. It's basically a series of cases in the UK about the recognition or the validity of prenuptial contracts. My colleague, the very eminent Professor Jonathan Herring in England, comments, and I quote, the 20th of October 2010, mark that date in your diary. It was the beginning of the end for marriage. On that day, the Supreme Court in Radmacher versus Granatino made a decisive step towards reducing marriage to a contract. Marriage diminished to a private, autonomous agreement between individuals. This marks a fundamental shift in the way we see marriage, in the UK, obviously. Traditionally, marriage was a status. This means two things. First, the parties are not entirely free to determine all its legal consequences for themselves. They contract into the package, which is the law of the land. And second, their marriage also has the legal consequences for other people and for the state. Now, Malta, which follows the civil law school, has long had this notion of marriage as a contract of sorts, a contract so shocking to Professor Herring. So what happens when the conjugal commitment is no longer, or where the revisionist romance, love and care have gone? What happens when marriage breaks down? A very quick tour of what happens in some countries. Italy's had divorce since 1974. Interestingly enough, Italian legislation doesn't speak of divorce. It talks about the dissolution of civil marriage, or the cessation, the termination of the civil effects of marriage celebrated by ministers of Catholic worship. as very interesting Article 3, which specifies the determination by the court of the existence of a practical impossibility of maintaining or restoring family life upon the failure of the spiritual and material union between the spouses. In contrast, Scotland first recognized divorce in the 1560s on the grounds of adultery. By 1573, they'd added desertion. And as time went on, in 1938, for instance, they recognized divorce for adultery, desertion, cruelty, as a whole list. The point is, there is a list. There is a fault attributable, and I'll come back to this very important issue. In 1976, Scotland provided for no-fault divorce, for irretrievable breakdown. You still need 2 years separation and the consent of both spouses, or 5 years separation. In England and Wales, a divorce is only possible for marriages of more than 1 year, and when the marriage, again, has irretrievably broken down. It's possible to defend a divorce proceeding, but the vast majority go ahead on an undefended basis. In Japan, which I'm sure we're all thinking about for other reasons, but in Japan, most divorces are consensual and fairly straightforward. The couple only has to sign, seal, and file a one-page form. They can be divorced without even going to court. Issues regarding children and child custody aren't dealt with within the divorce settlement, unless, of course, the child has citizenship, which is not Japanese. Moving very quickly across the globe, Canada. Canada's a very interesting case because Canada has shifted from a rather strict vision of divorce to an extremely open one. In the 60s, it took till the 60s for Canada to legalize divorce. Before that, you'd have to get your marriage dissolved by an act of parliament, like they did in England. In July 2004, though, a lesbian couple in Ontario, Canada, became the first same-sex couple in Canada to seek divorce. They had been together for nearly 10 years. They married in 2003, about a week after it was legalized, and then they separated 5 days later. The Ontario court ruled that the Divorce Act was unconstitutional and ordered same-sex marriage as of September 13, 2004. Divorce only became legal in Brazil in 1977. And since January of 2007, Brazilian couples can request a divorce at a notary's office when there's consensus, where the couple has been separated for more than a year and have no underage or special needs children. All they need to do is present their national identity cards, a marriage certificate, pay a small fee, and the process is completed in 2 to 3 weeks. Ireland, in 1997, introduced divorce, requiring, and I quote, that there is no reasonable prospect of reconciliation between the spouses for the decree to be granted. It goes a step further because it links the impossibility of reconciliation with the breakdown of spiritual and material union between the spouses. Remember Italy? The couple must be separated for 4 of the preceding 5 years before they can obtain a divorce, although sometimes the living under the same roof can also be taken into account as part of the separation period. Divorce only became legal in Chile in 2004. They have no provisions for no-fault divorce. The parties must prove infidelity, abuse, or abandonment, and they have a requirement of 1 to 3 years. Now, Las Vegas. This is taken from website. Obviously, if you Google Las Vegas divorces, you'd have a fantastic time. It's such an interesting, informative exercise. This is one little advert. Las Vegas is home to marriage, not to divorce. They proudly say it's home to marriage. You can get a very quick marriage in Las Vegas. But it's also well known for a quickie divorce. Their official website now claims that laws have changed. And you have to be a Clark County resident for at least 6 weeks before you can file a divorce. If you wait another 6 weeks, then divorce becomes final, unless, of course, there are complications. The process is simpler and cheaper when both spouses agree and there are no children involved. So there are three main statutory grounds for divorce. The first is incompatibility. insanity for 2 years prior to the action, and the spouses living separate and apart for more than 1 year. Regarding the residency issue, I found this extremely interesting from the legal point of view. You need to prove Nevada residency for 6 weeks. But there's a lovely company that actually offers to help you out here. They say that if one party resides in Nevada or establishes residency, then you can apply for your divorce or your annulment. And what they do is type a residence witness affidavit that another resident signs stating he or she has seen you living in Nevada for 6 weeks at a slight cost. Anyhow, no more comment on that one. So divorce has been around for an awful long time. The Code of Hammurabi, a lot of the legal students here are very up to date with this, goes back to what, 1800 BC, 1700 BC. Men could get divorced from their wives, no problem. They had to return the dowry to the wife, but otherwise, if there was a ground like adultery, divorce could go ahead. In medieval Europe, marriage became more of a church issue rather than a civil issue. On marriage, women were seen to become one with their husband. Divorce was rare, if not impossible. Marriage was a sacrament. Human beings didn't interfere with this. There was a compromise that permitted you to get a separation. It wasn't often that you were permitted this, but if you were, the marriage wasn't dissolved. But the man and the woman could live apart. Amensa et thoro, separation from the table and the bed, bed and board. We're all familiar with this under Maltese law. Over time, the courts extended exceptional grounds on which marriage could end. So not only did it include non-consummation and other circumstances at the beginning of the marriage, which are more akin to annulment, but it also started considering other factors during marriage, like cruelty and adultery. And in these cases, one party would have to be found guilty and the other party would be innocent. Courts weren't happy when both parties were guilty. They punished collusion between husbands and wives who tried to manufacture grounds. And this approach continued until the early 20th century, and it meant the number of divorces were very, very small. So in the main, divorce laws vary as to waiting period before a divorce is effective, residency requirements, and grounds. For instance, I have to bring the Philippines into this. If a legally married Filipino citizen obtains a divorce outside of the Philippines, that divorce is not recognized in the Philippines. But if the legally married Filipino citizen obtains foreign citizenship first and then secures a foreign divorce decree, that's okay. And I'll remind you that before 1975, Maltese courts categorically refused to recognize foreign divorces on the grounds of public policy. So following the enactment of the Marriage Act in 1975, foreign divorces were recognized if they conformed to Section 21, which is about a foreign court recognizing a decision given by a competent court of the country in which either of the parties is domiciled or where one of the parties is a citizen. There are different kinds of divorces. Summary divorces in the US, where basically there are certain eligibility criteria, like a short marriage, less than 5 years, no children, no property, or uncontested divorces. In the US, 95% of divorces are uncontested. That means that the couple agree. Could be helped through mediated divorce. In Portugal, they have very interesting innovation, an electronic divorce. The two people file an electronic request for no-fault collaborative divorce. And specific case, and in these cases where there are no children, no real property, and no request for maintenance, for alimony, they can be decreed within an hour. Finally, I come to the point I really want to make, which is about fault and no fault. So, under a no-fault system, divorce requires no allegation or proof of fault of either party. So, in countries that require irretrievable breakdown, the assertion that the marriage has broken down is sufficient. The state of Oklahoma passed the first no-fault divorce law in 1953. Since then, all states in the United States have no-fault divorce. The last to fall was New York District of Columbia on the 15th of October 2010, apparently. Malta may not have a no-fault divorce, but it has been possible to establish irretrievable breakdown, I quote, on the ground that the spouses cannot reasonably be expected to live together since 1981. Of course, there are arguments for and against no-fault divorce. The argument against is mainly that the easier it is to obtain a divorce, the less importance people give to marriage as a bond. No-fault divorce undermines society as a whole, and it makes the institution of marriage trivial. From a religious point of view, marriage is a covenant with God. From a secular point of view, it's a covenant with society. And there's a lot of feminist writing about no-fault divorce generally being considered very bad news for women. On the other hand, there's consistent research, mainly from the US, but not only, showing that when states do allow no-fault divorce, domestic violence declines. Allowing no-fault divorce proceedings reduces the time frame and financial burden between parties looking for divorce. It reduces heavy caseloads of family courts. It preserves the privacy of the couple, and there's less conflict and less emotional harm and injury. Finally, a central issue relates to whether marriage and marriage breakdown, including, but not only, divorce, is a private matter. If we look at the research, there's an easily quantifiable cost to us all. Baroness Ruth Deitch, who's coming to Malta for a symposium in July, sits in the House of Lords. She concludes that the material costs of divorce comprise some of this whole list of things. There's quite a lot of research been done in the UK regarding the cost of divorce and marital breakdown. And if you look at the monetary aspect, we have one group that estimates a conservative 20 billion sterling a year and another that goes up to 40 billion a year, because this also takes into account things like housing, welfare, running of the courts, the illness arising from divorce stress, which is documented, absence from work. Anyhow, there's a whole list of items. We in Malta already know this through our separation law. Countries with divorce legislation know this, and they, like us, continue to debate the impact of changes to marriage, marital breakdown, and divorce in the context of common good, which we're going to hear about. I hope that at the end of this, you're not in the last lane. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ruth, for that excellent whirlwind tour through divorce legislation in a number of countries. And of course, the question that arises is why do some countries, allow certain types of divorces and others much stricter types of divorces? What is the reasoning behind that? Why did the legislature choose one model in one case and another in another? Moving on with our debate, we're opening the first session now, and I'd invite the Reverend Professor Father Peter Seracinonglot to give us his views on why the common good is an essential criterion in the divorce debate. I'll just quote something Father Peter has said. He said quite a bit about divorce. Father Peter said, "Divorce should be permitted if it is scientifically proven that society is better off with it than without it." So with that, I leave the floor to Father Peter.
Actually, although that is what the newspaper printed as my having said, I did not actually say scientifically proven. I said reasonably proven.
There's a Times report in here, I believe. So you'll have to second that later.
Well, it was the Sunday Times, not the Daily Times. I think certainly that the common good is relevant to this question of divorce. But if you read that interview or several other statements which I made on the subject, you will see that I have never tended to oppose consideration of the common good to individual rights, although I will say something about that later on. Why I bring up the common good each time is to oppose that concept that it's the common good, which it's the impact on the common good, which should decide whether we legislate in order to allow divorce or not. I am opposing that to consideration of whether divorce is a good or a bad thing. That is the moral judgment of what divorce is. That is, I am willing to grant, for argument's sake, that divorce is always morally wrong. I don't actually myself think that that is the case, but that would be a different and also very complex argument to go into. But let us assume, for argument's sake, that divorce is always morally wrong. By divorce, of course, I mean remarriage or authorization to remarry after a first after a previous marriage has broken down. Now, if we admit that that is always wrong, it does not follow, this is my argument, that a state should not legislate to allow it. And the reason for this is, to my mind, quite clear. Not everything that is morally wrong, or if you want to put it in religious terms, not everything that is a sin should be made a crime, should be made punishable by law. And the reason for that, as I say, is pretty obvious, is because if a state tried to forbid anything that was morally wrong, it would have to be a police state, and not even the most efficient police states which we have had have ever been able to impose a complete prohibition of everything that was morally wrong. So if you tried to do that, you would bring the law into contempt because it would be more broken than observed, and that is the worst thing you can do when you are legislating. The fact, even if you consider a divorce to be always wrong, it does not follow that we should not have a law allowing divorce. What should be the considerations as to whether we allow divorce or not? Now, here the question of individual or minority rights comes in. My position is that if this was a human right, a fundamental human right, then we should not be discussing the thing at all. We should simply all be in favor of allowing it to take place, if this was recognized to be a fundamental human right, as the right to marriage is a fundamental human right. The general interpretation of this right, as you know, the issue of human rights is very difficult because we have these universal declarations and European declarations and other charters of human rights, but in no case do we have the rationale for these being considered fundamental human rights. I mean, of course, there are different theories, natural law theories and other theories, but it isn't part, for instance, of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So what we have to do is we say, well, the general interpretation of the law has been that the right to marriage is put there in order to exclude eugenic, for instance, legislation forbidding people to marry because they might produce handicapped children or things like that. That seems to be the reason why the right to marriage is asserted as a human right, because such legislation would be a violation of it. But it is not taken that this implies that if your first marriage breaks down, you are entitled to a second marriage. This is not recognized to be a fundamental human right. Presumably it would be had there been, as there are in some theories, a human, fundamental human right to happiness. Then, of course, as a consequence of that, you would have been able to argue that you have a right to divorce. But this right to happiness has not, in my opinion, very wisely been recognized to be a fundamental human right, because it would be very difficult to enforce legally, and unless there is enforceability, I don't think you should consider anything to be a fundamental human right. So this is my second assumption, that is that there is no fundamental human right to divorce. But, of course, this does not mean that you cannot argue that there are what have been called a civil right, or possibly a minority right. I mean, that is presumably this is because you have a majority of people who think that divorce is not good, shouldn't be legislated, but you have a minority who think that it should, and therefore these people have a right to enjoy that. I think I would be confusing matters if I argued against that. I don't want to argue against people who hold this. My position, however, is that what one should consider if one is considering whether to legislate in favor of divorce or not, is primarily, once having admitted that it's not a fundamental human right, because in that case I would grant it immediately, then it becomes something which is arguably a right or not at the individual level. So then I would say it's much more important to consider the effect on the common good. Now, I don't want to go into the very difficult task, which those of you who do philosophy of law know, it is to define the common good, or even the public interest, although that's is somewhat easier to define. I was looking before this at two books, one which is called The Common Good. It's a whole book about the subject. But if you see what he says to define the common good, basically what he does is he gives a list of the things which you find in a welfare state. I mean, that's his way of going about it. The other book, which I have here, contains a section which is devoted to the pastoral letter which the English Catholic bishops had issued before the election of 201, I think, which was called The Common Good. And the bishops were telling the British electorate, vote for the common good. I mean, this was the title of their pastoral letter. And if you look at that, I mean, I had originally thought I would go through an analysis of the paragraph where they say what they think the common good is. But It isn't worth philosophical analysis, the account which they give of the concept. I think for our purposes, just take it that it is not the utilitarian account of the greatest good of the greatest number, but it refers to a collective good, that is, not the summation of the good of the individuals, but of a good which belongs to the community as such. And that is what we are, in my opinion, to look at primarily when we are trying to make up our minds as to whether we should have divorce legislation or not. Because it seems to me that it is very easy to imagine certain situations in which it would be absolutely logical to want divorce legislation to take place, even if you think that divorce is always morally wrong for an individual to go into. I mean, the obvious situation would be a situation in which more children were being born out of marriage, out of cohabiting couples, than out of married couples, and if divorce were a remedy to this, would change the situation. Because in Malta at the moment, we are in a situation where one in four babies appears to be born out of marriage, but it does not seem to me, from since I don't have the statistics, nobody has them, that many of these, the majority of them, are unmarried girls, quite a number of them under school age. So it's obvious that having a divorce would not ease this problem at all. What I've always been saying is that, well, the first thing we should have been doing if we wanted to debate this issue seriously was get the facts of the situation in Malta, which we are still very far from having. This, I think, would give us a good ground for saying, yes, definitely, we should have divorce legislation. If we could show, for instance, that we would have many more children being born out of marriage, because the divorced, the separate couples would have remarried, then we would have then having them born out of marriage. But there are other considerations of this kind for the common good which are very relevant. Now, the supreme consideration, yes, I have to close, is, however, consideration of the children. Why it is so important for the state to have stable families is essentially not only because there are these other financial and economic considerations which have been mentioned, but is the interest of the children. I think the most interesting diversity in the legislation which we have been quoted is that with regard to children, because many cases where you have this request, no fault and on demand, they say, provided there are no children. And I myself think that this is the most basic consideration which should be kept in mind by the legislator in our case. At the moment, of course, there is some I think there is intrinsically doubt as to when you can say that a marriage has actually fully taken place. Within the canon law tradition of the church, which was also the civil law in Malta, there was always consideration that of marriages which were said to be matrimonium ratum, sed non consumatum. That is, the marriage ceremony had taken place, but they had not copulated, basically. Until that copulation takes place, then the marriage is dissoluble. This has always been the centuries-long tradition of canon law. Now, what I'm saying is, why should one regard the marriage to have been fully consummated and not just ratum, not just deemed to have taken place with copulation? Because copulation is what creates the possibility of having children. But I don't think it's pushing things too far to say until the child is born, then you don't have the full consummation. So I would think it very rational from a common good point of view to say that, to be very free in allowing divorce unless there are children. But when there are children, then the interest of the community as a whole comes to be involved, and one should be extremely reticent from this point of view to allow that to take place.
Thank you very much, Father Peter, for that roundup this time of concepts like the difference between fundamental rights, civil rights, the collective good, the common good, minority rights, and so on. Nonetheless, of course, this argument somehow boils down also to facts, statistics. So if you have enough statistics to prove that it's the common good is best served by introducing divorce, therefore we should introduce divorce. I'll move on now to Professor Kenneth Wayne. I've checked with him whether he had actually said the quote I'm going to quote now. Professor Wayne says that the divorce issue has become one about minority rights in our society makes it especially important because, as a society, notwithstanding everything, we believe in minority rights, rights that respect difference. So I'd like, I invite Professor Wayne to give us his point of view, I imagine focusing on individual rights in this divorce debate.
Well, first of all, I want to thank the Law Debating Society for inviting me to speak in the seminar. I'd been asked to speak about, as David has just said, I've been asked to speak about individual and minority rights and their relevance to the divorce debate. It's important to point out, you know, just as Father Peter has just pointed out, that what is being claimed by the pro-divorce lobby is that divorce legislation is justified as a civil right, not as some other kind of right, a human right or a moral right, for instance, or a political right, which are different kinds. There should be broad agreement, at least if rational debate is intended on this issue, that moral arguments or arguments based on one's conscience are irrelevant to it. For one thing, divorce legislation would not interfere with people's conscience or force their will in any way. It would leave them perfectly free to decide on what they want to do with their lives once it is available. On the other hand, those who want to deprive others from divorce legislation because they regard divorce as sinful or immoral in their conscience are simply being intolerant. They want to impose their morality on others. A referendum question that would simply ask, are you in favor or against divorce, is misleading in my view because it reads as a moral question. Whether one approves of divorce in general, when the real question is a civil one. Whether, irrespective of personal belief about its morality, one approves of legislation that would make divorce accessible for those who see it as the way to rebuild their lives after an unsuccessful marriage. Put in this way, as I believe it should be, the divorce issue becomes one about tolerance and about the limits of society's interference in the lives of a minority of its members. The present way of presenting it in the public debate as a matter of the common good obliterates this way of considering the introduction of divorce legislation, i.e., as an instrument for safeguarding the civil freedoms of people. In this case, the freedom to remarry with a new partner once one is legally separated by the courts. A few weeks ago, I wrote an article in the Sunday Times, which David has very kindly just quoted, arguing that the common good should be what the word common implies, i.e., the good of everyone, of every member of our society, not just the majority. I wrote it because I am disturbed by the politics of statistics employed by some people. The argument that divorce legislation is unnecessary for Malta because the percentage of marital breakdowns is comparatively low. This way of making the argument automatically raises the issue of minority rights. The common good, the argument continues, is threatened by the introduction of divorce. But this is the question I want to pose. Can this abstract entity, the common good, be measured with statistics, or scientifically for that matter? The clear implication, this utilitarian approach to the matter, is that it does not recognize minority rights at all, or that if they exist, they can be overridden in the interest of the majority, which means that they exist only if they are convenient for the majority. A strange and contradictory approach in a society which is usually vocally against utilitarian calculations over right claims, the right to life in particular. Also, an intolerant approach showing total lack of compassion towards a section of unfortunate people in our society, a total incapacity of our moral imagination to empathize with the suffering of these people who, vulnerable as minorities inevitably are, would expect its comprehension and defense. The attitude that can be read into the arguments, many of the anti-divorce arguments, is it's your bad luck or bad judgment that has landed you in this mess. Now stick with it, or cohabit if you want to. We can, as a society, offer little more than sympathy. Well, is this, I ask, the more enlightened or humane alternative to remarriage that is being proposed? I must make one thing clear. My Sunday Times article should not be taken to mean that I endorse the common good as the instrument with which to calculate the desirability or otherwise of divorce legislation. The common good is a notion that itself creates many problems for me, abstract as it is. How does one define the common good in a pluralistic society when people have different conceptions of the good? For instance, I strongly believe that the introduction of divorce legislation in Malta is a good, part of the common good, because it will benefit those who are harmed by a disastrous marriage
by creating closure, while not creating harm for others that is not created by the disaster itself. The threat of harm to children, which is a very, very important consideration, children from the earlier marriage, who are innocent victims of its failure, is not generally created by their parents divorcing. It is there as soon as the marriage begins manifesting its failure, even before the couple actually separate and go their ways, amicably or otherwise. And it continues whether the separated partners remain single or cohabit with new partners. Indeed, my intuition and my experience from what I have seen with other people I know is that the stability and sense of closure brought by the remarriage of their parents is more likely to benefit them against the two other alternatives rather than otherwise. In a society where there is no commonly agreed conception of the common good, the imposition of any one moral definition of it is an act of violence against the rest who disagree with it. This is why the state should be neutral between different conceptions, moral conceptions, of the common good, and where the protective machinery of civil freedoms comes into play. Let us remember that the language of rights, natural rights at first, was introduced into Western political discourse centuries ago to create a space of political and religious freedom for the individual against the arbitrary encroachments of states and societies. With the advent of democracy, the struggle for civil rights was first for the extension of the right to universal suffrage, the right to be a citizen and to vote and choose one's political representatives. Then, to ensure that democracies do not degenerate into tyrannies of the majority. The latter is achieved by recognizing the freedom rights of minorities to free conscience and expression, free assembly, and free lifestyle. Evidently, these freedoms are not absolute. I mean, this has to be understood, okay? They are subject to the condition that their exercise does not harm others. This, the principle of harm to others, I am suggesting, rather than the common good, is how the introduction of divorce legislation should be approached in the debate. The harm must be concrete and evident, some tangible form of violence against identifiable others. It cannot be declared in the name of an abstraction called the common good. And the onus of proof must be on proving the harm, not defending the freedom. Just as in the courtroom, it is guilt, not innocence, that must be proved. The onus of proof is on those who would curtail freedom, not advance it. This is true whether what is in debate is freedom of expression, of association, or of lifestyle, including for those who are victims of failed marriages. Thank you.
Thanks to Professor Wayne for that sometimes impassioned speech, and it's not a, not a bad thing to have some passion in this divorce debate, I suggest. Now we'll open the floor. In fact, we'll open the floor to students to reply or to make their own points about this, what we've heard now. So we have a student who is going to speak on behalf, if we like, of the common good principle, and another student who will speak on behalf or defend the individual rights principle. We are running a bit late, but we have been granted half an hour more. So we were running 15 minutes late, but we've been granted half an hour more. So our balance sheet time-wise is okay. So I invite the students to make their presentations.
Okay, so first of all, I'd like to make it clear that whatever I say is only in my personal capacity and not in representation of any organization I'm a member of. The common good principle. I definitely agree with what Professor Kenneth Wayne said, that when we come to the common good principle, we cannot simply put forward a set of statistics and argued that simply because the statistics show that only a small amount of people are affected by this particular problem, we can therefore simply dismiss them and move on. That is not the common good principle. That is utilitarianism, and it is a very dangerous argument to put forward. It is an argument which could promote several ideas which would be against fundamental rights. I disagree, however, with Professor Kenneth Wayne as regards the rest of the notions he put forward. The common good principle is not about taking statistics. The common good principle is about taking what is intrinsically good for society. And what is intrinsically good for society would be true both for the majority of the society and for the minority of society. Hence the term common good. Because it is not the good of the majority, it is the good of the common populace. So in framing the divorce debate, the question is whether divorce is good only for a minority, good only for a majority, or good as a concept. That is the question which common good would seek to answer. This is so true that, in fact, people who argue in favor of the common good principle would come to a different conclusion as to whether divorce can be seen as being in the interests of common good or against common good. Whilst Professor Wayne's argument is that if you look at common good, you're definitely going to be against divorce. And if you look at individual rights, you definitely have to be in favor. It may be true in the case of individual rights, but it is certainly not true framed in the context of common good. For common good analyzes the situation for the common populace. What's my personal view as regards to common good with regards to divorce? I don't think we can conclude that easily. It's an argument which has to be seen in many frames, and perhaps Reverend Professor Peter Seracino-Anglot put it beautifully when he analyzed first the concept of divorce as a concept, which, realistically speaking, one can definitely say that one can find common good arguments in favor, and then framing it in the context of children, changing the scenario somewhat, changing the arguments. These are the questions which common good seeks to answer, and which if one only looks at individual rights exclusively, one would perhaps ignore. This does not mean that common good, however, can do the same back and ignore individual rights. The common good looks at individual rights. It does not go over them in a bulldozer-style fashion. That would be utilitarianism, and it is on this point that, again, I stress, I completely disagree with Professor Kenneth Wayne. His arguments are based on utilitarianism, not on the common good. The common good would seek to see divorce through whether it would be harmful to society in general. And is divorce harmful to society in general? I would say yes. Anyone else arguing with the common good principle is free, however, to argue against that using the same logic. And that is why this is the logic we must adopt in deciding on this sensitive issue, because it's the logic which allows both arguments to be put forward in a secular way, not in a moral way in any way, not in a religious context in any way. For that, is free, one is free to believe or not believe. Thank you.
Thank you for that cogently put, also passionately put intervention. So I thank you for that. I now invite Mr. Marlon Borch to speak on behalf or in favor of or put things in the context of individual rights.
Okay, thank you very much. First of all, surprisingly, I must say that I tend to agree with much of what Professor Reverend and my colleague Angelo said. First of all, I tend to see that common good and individual rights are concepts which are not adversarial, but complementary. What I disagree is on the essential part of the argument. The Reverend Professor said, and please permit me to see what I jotted down. The Reverend Professor said that we should have statistics proving that, for example, that the majority of births are happening out of marriage and so on. I ask, is it fair to society to say we should have statistics proving that society is reducing into this sort of what I've said and what the referent has said? Before we should introduce divorce. Should we wait until we have the majority of births coming out of marriage?
Can you clarify that point, please? I didn't quite get it. Can you repeat that?
Okay, no problem. The reverend professor said that we should have statistics proving that, for example, he mentioned much of the births are happening out of marriage. Is it fair to ask society, to tell society, wait, we only introduce divorce if we have statistically proven that that most of the births are happening out of marriage? Should we leave this vacuum in law before seeing that this is happening?
What do you think?
I think no. I think we should introduce divorce legislation.
Irrespective of
something. Yes, obviously. And my colleague has asked another question. What is intrinsically good for society? And it all depends on what point of view you take. If you take the common good as the greatest good for the greatest number, you are not going to get any results. However, if you take the common good for all principle, I believe that the most common good for society would be to have a structure and an institution of family which is healthy institution of the family in society. I refer to Article 41 of the Irish Constitution, and I refer to the Irish law because we are basing our law similar to Irish legislation. And it states this: the state pledges itself to guard with special care the institution of marriage on which the family is founded. The state guarantees to protect the family in its constitution and authority as the necessary basis of social order and indispensable to the welfare of the nation and the state. What I'm saying now is that the first obligation of the state is to keep order in society. And is it order in society if what we have on paper written is not what is reflected in reality? Can we still say that it is a marriage, that marriage which has broken down and where both parties have gone their separate ways? Yes, the common good would be to maintain the structure of the family and not to institutionalize cohabitation outside marriage. I would say that we have to realize that with or without divorce, people will still commit mistakes and people will still fall victims to circumstances which are beyond their control in life. I have to stress one point. Looking at marriage, is marriage indissoluble?
If you could wind up, please.
Yes, I'm going to conclude. Okay. Marriage, civilly, is an indefinite contract, but surely not indissoluble. Even so in Malta. In Malta, it is dissoluble for those couples who are in a financial state to get a divorce sentence from a court outside Malta. So marriage in Malta is dissoluble. It is indefinite, like marriages in other countries. Yes, my last point would be that divorce legislation would give these couples who have their marriage broken down a closure on this part of their life and would give them the chance for a new life. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. I'll now open the discussion to the audience. Perhaps one could keep in mind, you know, you're a legislator in Parliament. You have, imagine, you're a city of 1,000 citizens. You know statistically that 4 of your citizens, you know, their marriage has broken down and they want to remarry. what do you do in this, you know, if you take things in the light of common good versus individual rights? Let's bring it down to basics. What would you do? So I'd like to, you know, challenge the audience after hearing what the speakers have said with this particular question.
I think what we have been hearing is not actually the pulse of the nation. I think one with experience in life will realize that there is nothing better than marriage, full as it was made up in the beginning, and that will last forever. I don't agree that we're trying to nip out little bits and pieces of what is and what has been handed over to us in four generations. I think that we should stand fast like a rock on what has been given to us. And in deference to this, I would like to quote what Ionescu, the one who wrote the paper of the absurd, wrote as regards this principle, when he said, we should keep the spirit of the holy going. He didn't mention Catholic religion in particular, but the spirit of the holy going, because religion is the rock. Compliance is not the path of anything. Compliance, trying to nibble out pieces of what has been handed over to us, will not give us any more pleasure in life, whatever has been said, will surely diminish if we try to reduce this bit of our inheritance.
Thank you. Thanks for that argument based on the tradition and the holy, which are, of course, arguments being made in this debate in this country. So it's fair enough. But I would like people to engage with common good versus individual rights. That's what we're speaking about today. That's the context I'd like this debate to be held in today. So please.
I've yet to see on the common good side how an introduction of divorce is against the common good. I've heard it is against the common good, but I don't see how individual rights and the allowance of a minority group to get a divorce in a situation which, as Professor Wayne already stated, is already a toxic situation. The children are already being harmed. There is and divorce can offer an opportunity for closure, resolution, possibly greater happiness. And in many cases, there are families that have grown out of cohabitation that aren't legally recognized. And I'm sure everyone in this room knows of at least one family or maybe even a family member that has basically what would be in other countries a common law marriage. They live together with what would be a spouse in another society and have one or more children out of wedlock, and yet these people aren't legally recognized. I don't see how the common good is being violated by divorce, and nobody's presented an argument. And the only arguments that I've heard touching on it are statistical arguments, as Angelo pointed out. That is a utilitarian view and a very dangerous view. And we've even heard of at least one statistic that goes in favor of the common good for divorce. No-fault divorce lowers spousal abuse rates. I don't see how that is against the common good, and I'd just like to hear anyone point out how allowing people the right to end their marriage and start a new life would be against the common good. Thank you.
Yes, thanks a lot for that too. I'll give Father Peter and Professor Wayne, let's say, 2 minutes each to answer this question and to build or to reply to what has been said. So I'll start with Professor Wayne.
No, there's not much really I want to say, except by way of clarification. Certainly, I'm not saying that the common good and individual rights are contrary concepts or anything of that kind. What I am saying is that I would prefer to see individual rights, okay, being regarded as part of the common good. And what I also say is that in this context, in the context of this type of debate,
okay? Given the precariousness of the notion of the common good, the safer way to go through it and the fairer ways to go through it is through the argument of individual rights. This is what I'm saying. So I'm very puzzled by the idea that in some way or another my point of view is utilitarian, because really I don't see it that way. Now, the other thing that I wanted to say very simply is, you know, that the point of my whole argument about the common good is that there is no way of defining the common good, okay, in a way that is intrinsically true or anything of that kind. I mean, there is, if I ask any individual over here to tell me what is intrinsically true of society or what is intrinsically good in society, okay, I'm sure that I'll probably come up with about 5 or 10, okay, different answers, and I'll probably find another 50 or more different answers elsewhere to add on to those 5 or 10. And I have still to be persuaded that there is any way of stepping outside the prejudices of people, the viewpoints of people, okay, to be able to establish in any kind of sort of objective way what the common good is. So, you know, my argument is very clear, that in the absence of any consensus in a pluralistic society of what the common good constitutes, because different people have different conceptions of good, okay, the more reasonable way is to put the onus of proof on those who want to deprive other people of a particular freedom. This is, in a nutshell, my argument.
Father Peter?
I said myself that it was very difficult to give a satisfactory definition of the common good. But that does not mean that we are totally at a loss as to what it could be. I am myself more surprised at the agreement that there is on these issues, for instance, on the recognition of what are human rights, than by the disagreements about them. And in this particular case, I think everybody is agreed that stability of the family is a common good, is part of the common good. And therefore, you have a criterion here. A particular piece of legislation, for instance, divorce, help the stability of the family or not? My answer was, in certain circumstances, if, for instance, it is going to make marriage more frequent than cohabitation, then it is going to help the stability of the family and of family based on marriage. But, in fact, we know that what usually happens, what has almost always happened, is that when divorce legislation has been introduced, there have been more family breakdowns. And this is where statistics is relevant. It's not so that the rights of the majority prevail over the minorities. Now, democracy is the will of the majority with respect to the rights of the minority. But if you have something which is going to definitely damage stable family relations, then you can very clearly say that is against the common good. And I think that's the answer to the question which has been put. How does divorce go against the common good? Well, if it is proven, and the way to prove this is really by providing the statistics of what has happened, if it is shown reasonably, because I don't think that you can give a scientific proof of this, that the divorce will destabilize even more than the family is already destabilized, then you can say it is against the common good.
thanks for that. I personally, this is, find, you know, the statistical argument a little bit difficult, for the simple reason that if you take 1,000 people in a society and 4 of them want to, you know, dissolve their marriage and marry again, what do you tell these people? I find it hard. I mean, why should an argument not be made that those people can dissolve their marriage and marry again? Would it be going against the common good for that scenario to be allowed? Well, we'll go on to our second session, divorce for or against. And here we bring in Professor Arnold Cassola, who is, of course, the AD, Alternativa Democratica, spokesman on EU and international affairs. Alternativa Democratica is the party which, since 1989, has been fairly consistent on divorce. And I would like to, you know, invite Professor Cassola to maybe give a short introduction to why that is. Professor Cassola has stated, it is absolutely unheard of in the democratic world that a political party does not take a clear stand on such a sensitive issue as divorce legislation. He then goes on to mention a number of political parties in Europe, and he says, can you just imagine these parties not taking a stand on such a sensitive issue? Professor Cassola.
Thank you very much. So before I start, whatever I say is absolutely not personal. It is very political, because I'm representing the only party in Malta that is in favor openly and officially introduction of divorce legislation in Malta. So, of course, I am saying it, I believe it, but it is also, I'm also representing political views. I find it very difficult to divide the personal from the political when you are in politics and so on. I think the first panel which pitted common good versus individual rights, it seemed to be a confrontation, something a bit irreconcilable. I think when we are, you know, safeguarding individual rights, we are actually enhancing the common good. And I believe that this is the way we should try and go forward, because they are not in contrast. The common good is made up of individual rights, of positive individual rights. So I believe this is the direction we should aim for. Now, what about, we're talking about, this is a legal congregation here. I am not part of the legal community. But what is the state of affairs as regards legality, if we look at the whole world? So basically, we have the world community, over 200 countries, except 3, recognize divorce. Now, have these people, are they all idiots, 200 countries? Have they had all this conscience crunching of ideas on individual rights, common good, etc.? I don't know. The fact is that over 200 countries in the world have decided on these issues. There are only 3 countries, only 3, that do not accept divorce. Not Malta. Malta accepts it. There are only 3. The Philippines, Vatican City, and Andorra. Malta accepts divorce. So we are basically here discussing, it's a futile discussion. The Maltese state recognizes divorce. Yes. Anybody who divorces, so long as not on Maltese territory, which is virgin, pure, etc., but if you divorce anywhere else in the world, this is recognized by the Maltese state. You can come here, you can be Maltese, come here, marry a Maltese. You can be a foreigner, come here, marry a Maltese. So what is the first problem? The problem is a question of civil rights. We believe that divorce, the possibility of attaining divorce, is just a simple civil right. It's not a human right, I agree. But it's a civil right to which one should be able to accede. We said Philippines, Vatican, Andorra, but be careful. Forget the Philippines, who do not recognize divorce, not even on their own territory, obtained from abroad, which Malta does. The Vatican, the head of state, is the Pope. So it's a religious state. Huh? Andorra, the head of state, is the Archbishop in Andorra. It's a religious state. As far as I know, President Jorge Abela has not yet taken his vows. So we are creating this further anomaly that the Maltese state is not recognizing the civil right obtained in Malta. It is recognizing it obtained abroad. but it is not recognizing it if it is obtained in Malta. We are a lay state, and we should have a lay approach to the issue, in our opinion. The second thing is discrimination. First was civil rights. Second thing is discrimination. Why should a Maltese citizen or a European Union citizen living in Malta not have access to divorce legislation, whilst a Maltese citizen or an EU citizen resident anywhere else can have access to this? What's the difference? Sorry. I believe that this would be a case, had we had the money, which we don't have, unfortunately, my party, we would have loads of constitutional cases to start off, which we would obviously lose in Malta, because that's what happens. The system is quite conservative. But then we would be able to go to Strasbourg, and that's where you need the money, unfortunately. Because this is a blatant act of discrimination between not only Maltese citizens, but also EU citizens. Today we don't discriminate on nationality, we discriminate on residency in the EU. So why should EU residents in Malta of any nationality be discriminated against? The third thing is the question of minority rights. Our constitution, even though you're doing our constitution, as you know, all right, and our laws, offer ample space. offer ample space and protection to minorities. Our constitution protects minorities. It protects racial minorities. It protects religious minorities. Our laws protect social minorities. When you have poor people, we have laws enacted to help them out. We have people with individuals with special needs, with individual needs, and our laws protect them. They are minorities. Why should there not be a law which allows a minority also to have access to divorce? Why? What's the big deal? I would also like to remind people that access to legislation on divorce is not an obligation. No one is forced to. It's just a possibility for those who would like to or need to or think they need to have access to the law. That's all. On the other hand, however, so therefore what is happening, that the minority is not imposing on this majority. If there is a divorce law, you are not forced to. That's why, in reality, we didn't believe that we should have been a referendum. There will be one, and we will be fully participating as a yes, as Alternativa. But there should not have been, because this is not like joining the EU. If you were against the EU, but we voted yes, everybody has to join, whether you like it or not. If you don't agree on divorce, if there is a law on divorce, you are not obliged to. You are not part of it. So there is a difference in that. But anyway, the minority will not be imposing on the majority. But by saying no to a law on divorce, the majority is going to impose on the minority for a long, long time. And this is not fair at all. Finally, a word to the lawyers, because my experience, not being a lawyer, is that lawyers are very much have a legal framework. And everything, look at things and how to interpret, how to sway, to show how good we are. Our articles on the final page of the Times of Malta go into all these barocchismi, etc.
Lawyers are.
Right. But
yeah. Really outnumbered.
Yes, I know. That's why I'm saying it. I enjoy being a minority provoking the majority. My final point. You cannot come about saying, we cannot have a no-fault divorce. All right, let's say there's that. First of all, I believe there is a no-fault separation, is there, as lawyers? Does it exist? So why do you accept a no-fault separation and you don't accept a no-fault divorce? No. That's number one. But the second point, let's accept the fact that you don't accept a no-fault divorce. You don't accept it. Peron Bart, don't come to me. I'll get you somebody with fault and real fault. Batters his wife left, right, and center. Ijiba blue, all right, and black. Mbata, and then you say, Mushueya, and then you say, sorry, you have a fault. And you cannot marry again, because if you marry again, you are going to batter your second partner. This is an argument brought about by an eminent lawyer who is also part of the opposition. Eminent, eminent lawyer. I'm saying this because it's of the no to divorce. Andre Camilleri, so he and so I wrap up. Let's not play about with these things. No, I'll tell you no fault. What did you think? Well, Bill fault, I'll tell you no, you can't. This is not acceptable. And at the end, as lawyers, think of emotions, think of sentiment, think of suffering. Compassion must be at the end of everything, not just the paycheck. Huh?
Thank you very much. Another impassioned appeal here, this time for the introduction, clearly, of divorce in Malta. Dr. Austin Bencini will speak about, on the other hand, why is divorce harmful to Maltese society. He might want to answer a couple of questions. For instance, is the majority in this case, by not allowing divorce, imposing on the minority?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Typical of this debate on divorce, people who practically have spent most of the activities with other people, with allies, on most other issues, find themselves on opposite camps on the question of divorce. Certainly, the vast majority of this table, we fought the battle for entering the European Union, and today we find ourselves, at least some of us, on opposite grounds. And I think this is the issue which divorce is a serious issue, and the common good, therefore, has to be very much assessed in terms of our national requirements. Unfortunately, the arguments of other countries and the arguments of, not statistics, but the arguments of other countries leaves me absolutely cold. It is the divorce and the family system in Malta we are talking about. And therefore, my position is not so much whether I am in favor or against divorce. My position is, has the Maltese family law, and here I'm not appealing to the lawyers, in other words, is our Maltese family regime successful or not? If it has proven to be disastrous, in other words, the social conditions of the Maltese islands have changed so radically that make our family, our traditional family structure malfunctioning, then we change it. And we can introduce divorce or many other social systems. If, however, our family structure that has worked so well for these islands over the past centuries, if it is basically sustaining the role the family has within society, then yes, the answer is simple. The family law in Malta, and here I'm not talking family law, the legalistic side, is in the common good. And here is where the debate now must go away from the theoretical to come a bit more into the practical side. The chairman told me, and even to talk even a title, is why is divorce harmful? It's a title not chosen by me. I would say that I would... No. But it is obviously one of the questions. Let me change it. Let me give one situation in which I would consider divorce... I turn the question around. When can our marriage law be harmful? In other words, our regime, which is the traditional family model, can it be harmful to our society? Because if it can be harmful to our society, then we change it radically. And there can be one situation, which fortunately has not occurred in Malta. If our traditional family law were to stop other types of fundamental human rights from developing in our island, then my first criteria for the common good is the observance of fundamental human rights. and that is where I place myself fairly and squarely. In Malta and post-war Europe, not to say post-war democratic world, the common good is identified fairly and squarely to the movement of fundamental human rights. Anything that goes against the movement of fundamental human rights, by definition, cannot be in the common good. In other words, when the common good is such as to crush the fundamental human rights, the rights of the individual, then it is the whole community that is losing. Now, this is plainly obvious. Let us come down to Malta. Why all this discussion that Malta is so unique and it is the only country that apparently has managed to wed the movement of fundamental human rights and family life? We have managed to wed it. And we are wedding it every day. So why change a successful model? Well, first of all, I'm taking the European Charter of Fundamental Human Rights. That is not a legal document. This is a document that all Maltese citizens and European citizens must cherish, lawyers or not. And there's a clear distinction. Respect for private and family life. So our fundamental human rights and our laws must, at all stage, put in the compassion factor. The compassion factor is to give couples and individuals the right of private and family life. That is Article 7. Article 9, which is a totally different article, gives the right to marry and the right to found a family. So we are talking of two different things. The right to family life is compassion. But then clearly, societies within the European Union and the world have to consider marriage. And it says the right to marry and the right to found a family should be guaranteed. Now, let us listen to this phrase. In accordance with the national laws governing the exercise of these rights. So the European Union law, and this is exactly with the position taken by the European Court of Fundamental Human Rights of Strasbourg, here we have unanimity. The family law of a country must reflect the needs of that particular society. So it is useless, a waste of time, and appealing to emotions at an electoral time to keep on saying, we are the Andorras and we are the whatever we are, you are the Vaticans and we are that. No, we are Malta. We don't want the Swedish, we don't want the Irish, we don't want the Las Vegas, we want our Maltese family law to work and to succeed. But in so doing, we must equally give rights to those who do not fit in within this model. Put simply, therefore, today we have fundamental human rights. Illegitimate children, that is children born outside wedlock, outside marriage, by fundamental human rights, are to be treated compassionately as children born within the family. So we see that we can have our traditional model as it is, without bringing in divorce and without breaking up that model, but at the same time giving fundamental rights to people who are in alternative right to enjoy family life. So we are in a unique situation. We can have the cake and eat it. And it is, let's stop making reference to other laws. Let's stop making reference to other countries. What is most harmful, and allow me to make this point, what is most harmful, and obviously this is being said with great respect to people I do respect a lot, is this constant reference, and to my mistaken, intellectually mistaken, reference to minorities. Fundamental human rights in no way qualify, and this is not from the legal aspect, but from the political aspect of what fundamental human rights is, qualify status as a minority. I, the same person, am a free citizen of this country. First, I become in the status of the unmarried. If I decide, I can become a status of the married. Then, unfortunately, I may fall into the status of separated. They are considered unanimously within every decision of the European Court of Fundamental Human Rights of Strasbourg to be considered separate categories. So if you are separated, and the people separated in Malta are a vast majority to the people who are married, no one has ever accepted the idea that separated people are a minority. So why should we today be introducing this alien idea to fundamental human rights that a divorced person becomes a minority? A minority is the Kurd in Iraq. A minority is the Catholic in Northern Ireland. It is a status that you are born with and you can't divest. But a minority is not, for some pensioners, so just because a pensioner, a person may have a status different from other people, because obviously not everybody can have the same rights of pension, doesn't make that category a minority. If the majority of people are working, does it make the unemployed a minority? And the answer is most definitely, intellectually, not. It does not mean to say, therefore, that people who are separated, people who are not married, don't have the right to a family life. That's a different issue. And in fact, the movement of fundamental human rights, and many judgments are moving in that direction, is you can preserve your marriage laws, and in Malta our marriage laws are certainly within fundamental human rights. In fact, it is our type of marriage law that is considered by European judgments as being the model of what a marriage should be. Rights can be given and should be given then to alternative forms of family life. Now, this is the reason why, therefore, we have to concentrate on the common good. The common good and the individual rights are the same thing, and it is thanks to the movement of fundamental human rights. In this regard, perhaps allow me to make a concluding comment. When we deal with the question of minorities, and when we deal with the question of foreign law, it's again a mistake to state that in Malta we have divorce because of the foreign laws. Allow me to make one last point. Two people who are Maltese, married in Malta, and are resident in Malta and domiciled in Malta, will find a great difficulty to get a divorce abroad. So let us stop thinking that marriage is to be treated differently from any other principle of private international law. It is false to state that we have divorce in Malta. Absolutely false. If there is a foreign element, then yes. If a foreign element, the vast majority of cases, and I hope we're not going to introduce a law of divorce in Malta, because there might be a statistical case or two that has introduced, that had our courts. Our courts will ensure that Maltese law is upright. Finally, I do wish to make one last consideration, and that this is not a case of division. The common good means that we all discuss the issue of the family and divorce. Unfortunately, the electoral element is going to make us divide more. I think this is going to be overall harmful to our family life. We hope that we can get through this referendum, and hopefully after that we will sit down, whatever the decision, and concentrate our efforts to make our family the success it has always been over the past centuries.
Dr. Bencini, for basically clearly stating that in your opinion, this is not an issue of minority rights, so we can clearly state that. I'll now give the floor to Dr. Deborah Shkembri, who is the chairperson of the EVA movement, and invite her to make her presentation.
Thank you. First of all, I just need to beg to differ, but in my dictionary legal or otherwise, if you're not in a majority, you're in a minority. And I do think that we are here talking about a minority of people. I remember a few years back sitting instead of you here, and I used to really believe that if you worked very hard at marriage, that if you did your best, that if you tried to choose the best partner possible, that you would have a happy marriage, that everything would do fine. And I think a lot of people that get into marriage want a marriage that lasts and wishes for a marriage that lasts. However, unfortunately, after 10 years of legal practice in family law, I see a lot of people whose marriages have failed. They have tried their best, but they have failed. I'm not saying that the majority or the vast majority of couples in Malta or marriages in Malta do not succeed. Most of them do perfectly well. But some of them, and they are not an insignificant few, irrespective of statistics, they don't fare well. And what do we do with those? Do we say, they're not a lot. They're not having children that are more than half of the child population, so we shouldn't really do something about it now. We should wait until half of the child population is born out of wedlock. Well, I don't think that makes sense. I don't think that we should wait to have things go that badly. I think we should act now. Because irrespective of how we try and improve the quality of our marriages, of those marriages that go wrong, there will still invariably be a number of marriages that don't fare well. And we cannot ignore that number. Now, it's important that I mention, as other previous people have here, it is really discriminatory to have a few people on this island who are capable of getting a divorce and move on with their lives if they have problems, and the rest of us can't. I remember being a law student. We were about 125, and now most of us got married, and some of us got separated, and some of us got divorced. And why should people who marry someone who is a foreigner have a right to divorce, and someone who marries someone who is Maltese doesn't? Why did some of us who went to work in Brussels have that right, and the rest of us don't? It is important to look at things in this perspective. We are all humans. We all try and look for our happiness. And sometimes, in marriage, it doesn't just depend on how hard you try. It also depends on the other party. Now, if the effects of divorce were terribly, you know, against anything that we've got already, then I'd say, okay, we should think twice. But we do have a system where we have annulments, for instance, and the effects of an annulment are precisely the effects of divorce. So if you are married and you get an annulment and you have children, you can still get married. You can still partner up with someone and have children of the first marriage and children of the second marriage. So what makes it different if you are divorced? Children look at the facts of what surrounds them, of whether they are loved, of whether they are in a stable relationship. They don't look at whether their parents are separated, divorced, annulled. They really don't look at it in those terms. For, if you ask me, someone who cohabits can easily pack up and leave. Well, someone who is married, at least, has a little bit more of a commitment. And children fare better in stable relationships, in relationships that are within a marriage setting, let's put it this way. So it is not necessarily, as some people say, harmful to children. Let me put it this way. Marriage breakdowns are not a nice situation, not for the adults and not for children. But divorce doesn't make it worse. When you get divorced, necessarily, under the new legislation that is being proposed, you would have had to be separated for at least 4 years. So, the children, the couple, the marriage has broken down already. The couple are already living in that reality. The only difference is the right to remarry. Not the right to partner up, because everyone can partner up. So we can't say, we don't have divorces, so people aren't partnering up with somebody else and children aren't living in second families. No, this is happening. So the difference is the right to remarry. And that right to remarry will make a difference to those people who wish to remarry, but it won't make a difference to the people who don't wish to remarry. And it is important to note that having a right to divorce and divorcing are two different things. People who are against divorce may very well be in favor of a legislation that is in favor of divorce for the people who need it. They don't mutually exclude each other. If for reasons of your own faith or whatever other reason you think that divorce is not for you, then fine, don't go for it. Or remarriage is not for you, fine, don't go for it. But why should you stop? Why should people who are fine in their marriages, who have lived a nice, happy life with their husband or their wives, stop other people from having a second chance? You know, it is utterly unfair. And children, with regards this issue of no-fault divorce, which is very much at heart, no-fault divorce is good. And I'll tell you why. It is good because there is not an aura of conflict around it. If you are already separated, then the reasons for having fault, which are basically the party at fault will forfeit maintenance, for instance, or the couple's community of acquests isn't split 50-50, that issue has been resolved in the separation process. So why put a fault at the divorce stage, just to create conflict, to have never-ending cases of divorces in our courts? No. The marriage has broken down. Divorce is a recognition of the state of fact that the marriage has broken down. When you have people who die, we certify them dead, we bury them. If the marriage is dead, we certify it dead and we move on. We cannot stop an illegal fiction. Our marriages can't be marriages on paper. If the love, the respect, the unity of the family has dwindled and cannot be recuperated, why should people be called married? Why should people have to remain faithful? Because otherwise they forfeit their maintenance, for instance. You know? Why all this? And why, for instance, don't we give the children who are so dear to us, who are being born of unions outside marriages from a second partner, why do we leave them as children born out of wedlock? Well, if their parents have a right to remarry or get this right to remarry, then they will be children like everybody else's within wedlock. What if I tell you, listen,
if you could wrap up, thanks.
If I tell you, listen, all of you here, you can't get married. You will have to cohabit, necessarily by force. What then? Because people who come to my office at your age with a broken marriage, some of them childless and some of them not, the law is telling them, from now on, at your age, you will have to cohabit. Somebody is imposing on you cohabitation. But the people who are against divorce are telling us, well, that is fine, because as long as you can put a family together and if you wanted that, then that's fine. No, it's not fine. For people who are married, that is fine because it's not their problem. But for people who wish to get married, we shouldn't say no. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Debbie. Incidentally, just to mention why we're having this debate in English, it's for the common good, because there are Erasmus students among us, and I believe some of them are here. I hope they are. So that's the reason we're debating in English and not Maltese. I'd basically like to refer to two quotes. The Minister for Gozo, Giovanna De Bono, has clearly put this debate in terms of the common good. She says that qualifying the common good as the greatest possible good for the greatest number of individuals, this should be the guiding light of this debate. And she tends to agree with Dr. Bencini when she says that this decision has to be based on social principles and moral values which distinguished the Maltese people from other people. On the other hand, in the same divorce debate in Parliament, the Labour MP Leo Brinkhardt has put it very strictly in terms of individual rights by stating that even if one, well, I guess he means two people, well, could be one, yes, one person in Malta needs divorce, it should be granted. So it's a completely different conception, of course, of this common good versus individual rights issue, which I'd like to ask to come back to. I'll now open the floor to two more students, one who's going to argue. I'll give you 3 minutes to argue about against divorce, and another student arguing for divorce. We will then, because this is, you know, the beauty of debate, come back to the floor for their final issue, for their final arguments in favor for common good individual rights in this debate. Thanks a lot. So the floor to the student.
First of all, I would like to say that I am here out of my own personal capacity and my opinions do not reflect any affiliation I might have to some organization or other. Rather than arguing against divorce, I am concerned by the introduction of divorce. I do not believe that divorce is some apocalyptic menace which will wreak havoc on society as we know it. On the other hand, I do believe that through some serious conversation and debates, we can get across to a common position, which is, after all, what we're after, the common good. I am concerned, mostly, by the lack of information revolving around the divorce debate. We have the No movement and the Yes movement, which are saying practically the same things over and over again, and which are going nowhere except in circles. Yesterday, I sat down and tried to watch a particular program on television. I couldn't keep up. Nothing. Being only... being only 20 years old, oh, 21, sorry.
Well, I hope that the debate here is a bit clearer than that television.
It is a lot clearer than what it was yesterday, or in most other programs or radio or television. Being only 20 years old, I remember only one other referendum in which we were inundated with information. We used to throw out leaflets before even watching them, because we knew what they were saying. Everyone was speaking about the European Union. We were overflowing with information. On the other hand, we have a referendum in a few months' time. The debate issue, the divorce issue, only came up a couple of months ago, and which the franchise have no idea what they are voting on. A walk around university will easily tell you that not many students know the difference between divorce, separation, and annulment. For many people, it is practically the same thing. I tried asking a couple of my friends a few days ago. For them, it is either the same thing, or with a few differences. The message is not coming across from both movements, which is leading to further confusion. A 2010 date survey conducted by Health and Lifestyle has portrayed that only 3.8% of the Maltese married population is separated. This shows us that the marriage institution is still strong. Why do we need a remedy for something which is still going as strong as that? We have an over 90% healthy marriages. Should we abandon these people? Of course not. We shouldn't abandon these people, but neither should we introduce divorce as an easy way out. Is divorce a solution? Possibly. Is it the only solution? Not probably. Why aren't we looking at other ways in order to facilitate the lives of these people without introducing divorce? Is our legal system ready for divorce? We have a private members bill, yes, but it's practically copied from another legislation. We need our own legislation to deal with our own personal issues. It's Maltese legislation we're speaking about, and not Irish. Thank you.
Thank you, Edward. I would like someone, maybe the next speaker, can grapple with this. Simply, what if in a city of 1,000 people, 4 people want a divorce? Why is it wrong to offer them that situation. I'd intellectually like some sort of answer. Yes.
No, I would like to just keep it short and simple. My point is this. I'm in favor of divorce and definitely in favor and definitely agree with Professor Wayne Cassola and Dr. Sabin Shkembri. Because I consider it first and foremost an individual right, irrespective if it's a minority issue or a majority issue. By the same argument, you can say that you can't have the common good if the individual rights are not respected. And after all, I mean, I am definitely in favor to give a second chance, because everybody is entitled to a second chance, irrespective of the situation, in my opinion, especially when it comes to marriage, because it's a common knowledge that marriages do break up. It's quite difficult nowadays, even more. That's the points which I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, now we will come back to the panel, and we'll keep it very short this time. So if we could start with Dr. Bencini, let's have 2 minutes each. 2 minutes.
I fully agree with my friend, my colleague is my friend also, but my interlocutor down there, that unfortunately the debate in television is becoming a circus. Being allowed to 4 to 5 seconds. It's already difficult here, so let alone in a television program which allows you only 4 to 5 seconds to express your thought. And I wish to congratulate extremely the faculty and the Law Society for what I think is a very, very good initiative. My 2 minutes start and in a simple point. I want to answer a bit, Dr. Shkembri is not here, but I'm sure we'll be meeting each other for some these coming days. My greatest objection, now we're talking now not on the common good, on divorce. The present law, unfortunately, changes completely the parameters of our family law. It is now being considered a contract. So all this talk about compassion, which there is a lot of suffering around. But then, how do you solve suffering of people who are facing difficulties in marriage by having no-fault divorce? And by translating a marriage into a contract. I was reading the Financial Times of 2 months ago, and it proved, and it said so, that divorce is becoming abroad a financial situation. People are even entering into contracts today with they are getting married, and the moment they get married, they already have a settlement for when they get divorced. Where is compassion? This is pounds, shillings, and pence. So the present law that we have at the moment in time is nothing else but, at the end of the day, a way of dissolving a company. Why should we translate marriage into a way of dissolving a company? So we have to be extremely careful that today, the law of divorce, there is compassion and there is suffering, but the solution being offered is purely financial. One small thing what Dr. Root said. In New York, she was very much correct. New York, there was no-fault divorce. It was only introduced recently, and they had a divorce regime. They had a divorce regime. The biggest people who fought against the no-fault divorce were the Association of Women, who considered the bargaining power in divorce settlements to be, settlements to be weakened by no-fault divorce. And these are people in favor of divorce.
Thanks for that. Moving on.
Yes. I think the financial arrangement has always been there. You mentioned before the return of the dowry in Hammurabi's time when you were divorced. If you look at notarial contracts, which I work on as a linguist or whatever, they're all full of, dota, and it's an exchange between the security, it was in the past. The man gave, and the woman brought her tovaglie and her lenzuola and whatever they were. Number 3 points on which I do not agree with you, for a change. number one, you said you gave the impression that divorce goes against human rights. I still have to understand how the granting of divorce seems to be going against human rights. That's how I understood it. So my wrong perception.
But I'm going to stop you there. Some reclame. Yeah.
Okay. Second point. I don't agree that you are born a minority. Tony Blair was born an Anglican and he decided to become a minority by becoming Catholic. Daniel Bogdanovich was born in Yugoslavia and he decided to become a footballer for Malta. Dr. Helga Ellul is a German who has decided to be the president of the Maltese industrialists. These are all people who are a big majority and decided to become minorities, and so minorities can also be people who are not born minorities. Final point, which I find quite shocking, is that you say that we should never refer to things abroad. In this case, we have referred to so many things for the EU, to join the EU, saying why it is good for it was so good for the Irish, why it was good for the Irish and why isn't it good for us, and now we don't do that. And then when our law is based on Roman law and Napoleonic law, and you say we should not look at foreign legislations, mava.
We even allow Italian expressions in here. Professor Wayne.
Okay, I'll just say a couple of things. One of them is that I'm entirely in agreement with Arnold when he says that minorities are created. They don't born. People are, you can be born into a minority, but minorities are also created. The other thing I wanted to say is something about this traditional family model, which everybody keeps talking about. I mean, what exactly are we referring to by a traditional family over here? Are we talking about the old patriarchal family where the father was boss, the wife had to suffer authority, and the children had to? Is this what we mean by a traditional family? If this is the case, okay, then we are well rid of it. And also the idea that he mentioned earlier on, you know, in our family law of non-interference with the family unit. I mean, say that to people, that the state should not interfere in the business of the family when you've got, for instance, wives who are being beaten up by their husband behind closed doors. Are we going to say this? I'm sure that, you know, if you had a feminist audience, they would be up in arms about this. Because, you know, this is exactly the conception of the family that feminists have been fighting against for ages. Apart from that, the reality around us is not that. On the one hand, we're encouraging women to go to work, you know, and to bear the economic burden and to be part of the world of work, to be educated, to develop their profession, etc., etc. On the other hand, we want to say that we want to retain the traditional family model. I mean, the traditional family model is very clear. You had the husband staying at home, going to work, the wife staying at home, raising the children. But this is the traditional. Will you allow me to? Didn't misquote you.
Let's not do a sharabank,
no,
shall we?
No, Austin, let me tell you. Explain to me what a traditional.
As if I ever would say that.
Okay, tell me what a traditional male family model is.
What the fundamental human rights has decided to be: a man and a woman married together, having children, and being considered as a family unit. That is the traditional family. And divorce doesn't come into part of that equation, as if I am ever going to say that the role of the woman is at home forcibly. If she wants to take it, she takes it. I have never, ever applied.
But if you look at it in the context of our society and of Western societies, okay, this may not be what you intended, and I grant you. I'm sorry. No,
okay.
I didn't.
Let's move on.
I said is that the traditional family within the Western conception of what a traditional family is exactly the way that I described it. Now, if you meant something different by a traditional family, but a traditional family meant that. So if we're continuing to dwell on this nostalgia for the traditional family, I suggest that we look at the reality around us in our own society.
Thanks for that, and for that exchange. I'm going to refer back to Dr. Farrugia. Maybe she can enlighten us a little bit about what the traditional families are. or what modern families are. And I'm going to give Dr. Farrugia a bit more time to do that.
I wasn't expecting to do this, although thank you for the invitation to say something. It's been quite frustrating listening to everyone give their 2 cents worth and not be able to say anything I feel quite strongly about. Now, there are a couple of things I would like to say. One of them, I'm not going to give you a definition of family. People here know that there's no way I'm going to offer a legal definition of family. No such thing exists. And anyway, we should be talking about families, not family, but that's another issue. What worries me more than anything in this debate is, apart from people taking sides and people that I thought were my friends thinking that I'm the devil incarnate because I'm on a particular side, is the fact that when you talk about divorce, we're not looking at how things are going to change. What exactly is divorce going to do to alter the law? How is it going to change people's rights? Austin cited the Charter. I'll go on to the Convention. If you look at Article 8, we're talking about respect for the right to family life. Respect for the right to family, not the right to family life, respect. And the right to marry and form a family. As all the law students here know, there hasn't been a case about the right to marry since the 80s, since 85, when Johnston versus Ireland failed before the European Court of Human Rights. That's a very long time ago. I don't know what would happen if it went there again. But the issue is, what would change? We have a separation law. We have no fault separation. What would substantially change if we had divorce? And to be very honest, although I can see Austin's nostalgic vision of the family, and I like that idea, well, in today's world, the people I meet don't have the same system, Austin. Regarding contracts, that's why I quoted Jonathan Herring. The Radmacher-Granatino case in the UK caused a huge stir in October because all of a sudden marriage is a contract. But marriage has always been a contract in Malta. It's been a special kind of contract, but it is a contract. And it confers a status. But if it were not a contract, we would not have prenuptial contracts in Malta. We would not be able to regulate what happens within the confines of the marriage. True, there are public policy issues relating to what happens to children and what happens to maintenance. But they're there peripherally because of public interest issues, not burdening the state with having to maintain people, as well as, obviously, the wish for the common good. I'm going to stop there.
Thanks a lot for that. Two things. Perhaps the debate in Malta about divorce is a bit more difficult, because I might disagree with you that it's only a contract. I believe that conceptually in Malta, it's also, because of our history, because of our history, culture, and so on, it's also held to be, in people's minds, a sacrament, right? This might be one of the stumbling blocks we have in this debate. I'm going to do, though, a little bit of an unorthodox thing for debates. I'm going to, this sometimes happens in UK debates, I'm going to take a count. We're going to vote. We've got 10 minutes, and we're going to take a vote. And the vote today, because our debate is about common good versus and individual rights, is I'd like to see the percentage of people in this audience who are convinced by the individual rights argument. It's not divorce against non-divorce. It's those who are convinced by the individual rights argument in the context of divorce and those who are more convinced by the common good argument. So I hope this is also a good hook for the people at the Times there and other people who might be other people from the press. And, excuse me, let's not take a vote.
They don't want to vote.
Respectfully, I don't agree with the vote simply because I'm listed here in the program as arguing for the common good. However, yeah. I do not see the common good and individual rights as being in any way contradictory to one another. I, for starters, would not be able to raise my hand and say I agree with common good because it's common good in the light of individual rights. They have to be taken together in a whole context.
Yes, but at the end of the day, right, at the end of the day, with respect, the debate in Malta is nowadays going in this way. So people are arguing for the common good and therefore saying no to divorce. Some people are arguing for individual rights or civil rights or human rights and are arguing for divorce. So I'm going to take this vote and see what happens. I'm going to take a referendum risk here. So will this be popular? You can also not vote, of course. That's your right. So let's take a count. Who, and I hope there won't be people who are shy here. I mean, we're beyond that. Who is convinced by, nonetheless, the individual rights argument? Let's take a count. So people do feel convinced by this argument. We've got 39, I believe, right? 39, right. 39 people convinced by the individual rights argument. The common good argument. That's 9. And I'd now like the people who don't believe that the divorce debate should be talked of in this light. There are some people who voted 3 times now. So we've got the majority. The majority. Okay. So my question to you, if the majority seem to agree that it shouldn't be debated in this light, I'd like final 2 minutes, people who have voted in this way, to suggest in what light it should be discussed. So I'm going to challenge you now. Yes, the gentleman in red. I'd like 2 students, and we'll wrap up the debate with this.
I think the whole issue is going away, going around the wrong way. I believe, first of all, it should not have been imposed on the people. A law of divorce or a law for chipping a dog or for fireworks or for hunting should be debated in Parliament, a vote taken freely by the members of Parliament who have the mandate of the people to this imposing on us. This is escapism. This is hypocrisy. And this thing about divorce or not divorce, It's an offense to our intelligence in reality because it is a common good, it is an individual right, it is a minority, whatever it is. So let's stop separating the people because this is what it's doing here in Malta. This is putting people against each other, which is not fair. I'm in favor of divorce because I'm in favor of freedom.
Freedom. Okay. Freedom. That's the word I wanted. Freedom. Someone else. If I could stop you. Someone else. Freedom. So freedom is the way we should debate it.
Freedom. Now, whether it's the divorce.
Someone else. Someone else.
Please.
Someone else. Yes?
I think that even individual rights, it's a common good. So every individual right.
Is part.
Yes, it's part of a common good. I agree with John. Yes, that they're imposing us to vote in favor or against divorce. I think that the members of parliament, as he said, are elected to represent us.
So what is it a question of?
No, so basically, we're doing it, we're making this statement, this question, divorce, yes or no. Uh-huh. A political thing.
It should be political.
I don't think
take a position on it, so it is inherently political. So
exactly.
So what should it be? You said what it is at the moment. What should it be?
No. The problem is we don't have enough information about what's the consequences of divorce.
They tell you it's not. But
the consequences of divorce and if it's voted yes or no.
Thanks. You've gone past your time. Thank you.
Let me use the word present marriage.
Okay, I'm going to, you know, it went in the
I have a question.
We have 1 minute left.
Okay, so the please. Answer, my answer to your question is the present, let's not use the word traditional, because it has been, the present marriage setup favors a stable marriage without stopping the rights
what they call the minority rights. Divorce will upset this careful, delicate balance our family law has managed to find of a stable marriage with minority, what they call minority rights, being protected by fundamental human rights. Mm.
Thanks a lot. If you can be brief, that is 2 seconds, I'll accept your question. And that's the last one. We'll wrap up the debate now.
Just one little comment. If our families are so strong, if our traditional family or normal family we should have are so strong, how will divorce ever ruin it? What is this fear of divorce if our families are so strong and they are so great? We need divorce because there are problems in families, not because our families are great.
With that question, short and sweet, I'd like to wrap up this, I believe, successful debate. I'd like to thank all the speakers. I'd like to thank Dr. Austin Bencini from the No Movement, Switch Bladivorci Movement. Switch Bladivorci, yes. It's a Switch Bladivorci Movement. Professor Arnold Cassola from AD, Professor Kenneth Wayne, Dr. Ruth Farrugia, and Dr. Deborah Shkembri, and the Reverend Professor Peter Seracino-Glott. I thank you for attending, and I look forward to seeing you at our next debate on campus. Thank you very much.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Law Debating Society in collaboration with Ines Sell and Elsa Malta, entitled Common Good versus Individual Rights in the Light of the Divorce Issue. This debate was chaired by Dr. David Frigeri.